joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The wildly successful Cash for Clunkers program and the news the Chevy Volt is expected to earn a rating of more than 230 miles per gallon has some seeing brighter days ahead for the U.S. car industry. But GM's hybrid won't be available for another year. And some view the government's program to get people to trade in their cars as nothing more than a short-term fix that won't address the industry's long-term problems. Joining me in the studio to talk about the current state of the Big Three and what the Chevy Volt could mean for GM. Here in the studio is David Shepherdson of the Detroit News. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Diane.
Joining us from Boston is Rebecca Lindland of IHS Global Insight. Good morning to you, Rebecca.
Good morning, Diane and Dave.
And by phone, Warren Brown with The Washington Post. Good morning, Warren.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Glad you could all join us. We'll be taking calls 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And joining us now by phone from Michigan is Tony Pazawatz. He is Vehicle Line Director with the Chevy Volt. Good morning, Tony. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. Tell us about GM's announcement this morning about a lithium battery assembly plant.
Diane, I'd love to. I'm actually calling from Brownstown, Michigan, where we made our formal announcement that General Motors will not only be building the Volt in Michigan, but also will be building advanced lithium-ion battery packs and modules in Michigan as well, employing a lot of U.S. workers and a lot of U.S. skills and talent. And this is the battery pack, 16 kilowatt hours of energy, that will go in the Chevy Volt that will allow most customers to drive gas-free with 40 miles of battery electric power.
Tell me how you estimate that 230-mile per hour rate.
Well, the 230 miles per gallon estimate is really something to help customers understand the difference between a Volt, which is an electrically driven vehicle and only uses gas as a backup system or to extend your range, which normal battery electrics can't do. So when you go beyond 40 miles, you drive electrically, but your onboard generator is what creates the additional propulsion. Most people, based on a bunch of Department of Transportation studies and the like, and matter of fact, 60% of the people in our country drive less than 30 miles. So for those people, and if they plug in just once a day, their fuel economy on a Volt would be infinity. Working with the EPA, we've said, you know, that's a little bit of an unbelievable number. Let's try to give a representative number to include people who go more than 40 miles a day. And it does give you a benchmark, 230 miles per gallon versus conventional cars. This, for us at General Motors, is a game changer.
Okay. I want to talk about that game-changing aspect in just a minute, but 2 points. First, I gather the EPA has not yet tested a Chevy Volt and therefore has not yet confirmed the fuel economy claims that GM is making, correct?
Diane, that is correct. Volts are being tested in many different places by General Motors today, but the EPA draft procedure does apply to any plug-in vehicle, whether it's a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle or an extended-range electric vehicle like a Chevy Volt.
Okay, and now my second question, far more personal. I happen to live in a condo building. What happens to me?
Well, the Chevy Volt only requires one charge a day to go 40 miles. As such, when you are sleeping at night, on a standard 110-120-volt outlet, it's a 6 to 8 hour charge, and with off-peak electricity rates, that would cost you about 50 cents to charge your car. We're hoping, with many of the efforts to improve our infrastructure, that we, as the car company, will get support from the utilities, from the government, to help provide those kind of alternatives for people so they can drive gas-free. And we see a lot of energy happening in that space.
Tony Pazowicz, he's Vehicle Line Director for the Chevy Volt. And just one last question. When can we buy the Volt, and how much is it going to cost?
We usually price the vehicles much closer to market introduction, but the Volt will be available for sale in November 2010. That was General Motors' original target, and we're right on track to deliver that. We will have vehicles out earlier than that to be tested, whether it be through the EPA, customers, electric companies, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things we like to mention to folks is the price tag is less important than the net price you pay. So assuming you believe reports that it may be in the high 30s, the federal government will give you a $7,500 tax rebate. Additionally, there's $1,000 available to make sure your home is...
Oh, dear. We've lost the line. We are having trouble with these lines this morning. I'm so sorry about that. Let me come to you, David Shepherdson. Is the Volt a game changer?
No, I think it is, in the sense that, you know, GM is still regretting the fact that it killed the EV1 at GM's electric vehicle program in the 1990s that got a huge amount of attention, and as a result, sort of ceded some of the environmental mantle to companies like Toyota, who got a huge amount of success out of the Toyota Prius. I mean, the Volt is probably going to sell no more than 10,000 vehicles a year for the first few years, which is not a huge number, but what it can do is not only change people's image of GM, but bring people into the showroom. So if someone comes in and decides the $40,000 Volt is too expensive, they might buy a new Chevy Cruze, which is coming out about the same time, a small vehicle that should get about 40 miles to the gallon on the highway and a conventional engine. So, you know, GM has spent a huge amount of time and effort and money on this program, and I do think it has the ability to change people's perceptions of the company.
Warren Brown, I gather you've driven the Volt. Don't tell me we've lost Warren Brown as well. My goodness. Well, Rebecca Litton, how many of these first-generation Volts do you think GM plans to sell?
Well, Diane, you can hear me, right?
Yeah, I can. Thank goodness.
We have a forecast a little bit higher than what Dave indicated. We do only have a couple hundred out for 2010, and then we've got about... I think about 12,000 for 2011 and about 20,000 for 2012. We are working closely with some of the battery suppliers on this ramp up and these estimates, and that's about what they're estimating as well. But I have to say that I have the exact same concerns that you addressed with Tony, and I've been involved with GM and the Volt program in terms of getting data and seeing information on it since 2006. And I live in a condo in Boston as well. And my first question to them was, where am I going to plug it in?
And what was the answer you got?
Well, a couple of different things as the years have progressed, because I still live in a condo. And basically there, and I checked this out with GM just yesterday, they are working with municipalities. Another more creative program that I really want to see them explore is working with companies and with corporations, because let's face it, most of us get about 6 hours of sleep, and most of us are at the office about 10 to 12 hours. So I'd like to really see them working with corporations and you know, big building parks to get these outdoor plugs, because they are just a standard outlet. So they are very inexpensive to run. But the problem with that plan, of course, is that then you get into daytime grid issues when the grid is being used so heavily. But the condo living situation is really something that's a very significant problem, I think.
I could see, especially with in-building below ground parking areas, that those kinds of outlets could be installed rather easily.
And I was just talking to GM, sorry, yeah, Rebecca, ahead, just yesterday, that they are talking to parking garage companies and utilities about finding ways. But Rebecca's right. The key issue is finding ways to charge the vehicles in off-peak hours to keep the rates down. Certainly, if you were recharging the Volt during the day, it's going to be much higher than the 50 cents a figure that Tony was talking about.
So how long is it going to take to pay off a car like this, the value? If you're spending, say, $40,000 for the car, how long will it take before you sort of break even on what you would have spent on gasoline, what you're spending on electricity?
Well, it certainly depends on the price of gasoline. I mean, right now, given the gas prices are in the $2.50 to $3 range, it's going to take a lot longer than if we're at $4 a gallon. I mean, if you figure the vehicle's $40,000, but minus the $7,500 tax credit, it's going to be somewhere in the low $30,000 range. And it depends on the number of miles you're traveling and number of years you own the vehicle. But certainly at today's prices, we're talking about in excess of 5 years, certainly, to get that repayment period.
Is it going to be a lighter car, David?
Well, Dave, can I just add one thing on that?
Sure, go ahead.
It will be a shorter time period to pay off the difference in the price than a hybrid vehicle, right, though, because the hybrids right now, like a Prius and a Honda Insight, our estimation is 10 to 12 years with gas at $2.50.
Right. Rebecca.
Rebecca yes,
Lindland, she's Director of Automotive Research for IHS Global Insight. David Shepherdson is Washington Bureau Chief with the Detroit News. We're talking in this hour about the big three and the star of the future, so GM tells us, the new Volt. Now, when we talk about the Volt, at the same time GM is coming out with the Volt going green, they have a popular new Camaro. What's happening there, David?
Well, I think the Camaro is sort of touching, that part of people who, want to remember the muscle cars of the 60s and 70s. And, it's a vehicle that people are probably not buying because they need basic transportation. It's
a show-off.
Right, sure. It's a vehicle they want to cruise down, Woodward in Michigan.
It's a gas hog.
Well, it does consume more gas than a lot of other vehicles, but it does have a more fuel-efficient version. In fact, that just has four cylinders. I don't know. Rebecca, do you know the fuel economy?
We had a V6 in the office about 2 weeks ago, and I got about 29 miles per gallon on the highway, and I wasn't shy about exceeding the speed limit. So our fuel economy was actually quite good in it.
It certainly is far more fuel efficient than the sort of muscle cars of a previous age. And it's an example of, GM bringing its fuel efficient technologies to a big vehicle. I think a lot of people, the reputation of the Camaro is probably more inefficient than it really is.
Right. Rebecca, you've said that the Volt is about solving the long-term GM problems. But what about cash for clunkers in the short term? How has that worked?
Well, you know, Cash for Clunkers is really such an interesting program because we didn't have a really – we were not very enthusiastic about this program, and it actually really far exceeded our expectations, mostly because two things happened. A used car owner turned into a new car buyer. And that was something that was a bit unexpected. We really hadn't anticipated that so many people with clunkers would be willing to plunk down and basically incur new debt. But the deals, the automakers really stepped up, and it started with Chrysler doing a matching number. So suddenly you go in and you're getting $7,000 to $9,000 off of a vehicle, and the deals were unbelievable. So I think that all the manufacturers, except the luxury end, because there was a price cap, they really benefited, and they certainly all benefited from an increase in showroom traffic.
What kinds of cars are people trading in, David?
Well, the vehicles have to be no more than 25 years old.
Right.
And but all top 10 of the vehicles that have been traded in as of last week were all large American vehicles, pickup trucks, SUVs, and minivans. And just today, I spoke to the Department of Transportation, and through this morning, the current total is 338,659 vouchers, totaling $1.4 billion. So we're almost halfway through the $3 billion in nearly 3 weeks. And at the rate that the money is being used, I think the program will probably last somewhere in the 3 to 4, possibly 5 weeks, but there's not...
More.
Because we're about halfway through that $3 billion.
Okay.
But we're also seeing companies like Ford, Toyota, GM, and Chrysler increasing production, especially of the smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. Toyota said yesterday they're going to increase production by 65,000 vehicles, and Ford is doing the same with its Focus, which has been number one for much of the time in terms of the most sought vehicle under the program.
I thought that Toyota and Honda were outselling the others. You're saying Ford is number one?
Well, they were the number one vehicle, but you're right. As of the last data, the big three were getting about 45% of the vehicles, about the exact same percentage they hold the market. But you're right. But four of the top five vehicles are both Toyota and Honda vehicles, and the Corolla has been number one.
Okay, here's an email from Bob, who's a retired mechanical and electrical engineer. He says, GM claims the Volt will be rated at 230 miles per gallon. I think the figure is misleading, since it appears they're fudging the numbers on the mileage and they're silent on the performance capabilities of the gas engine. I'm concerned the car may not be worth waiting for. In my case, my Insight with the battery empty can reach 70 miles per gallon in second gear on hills, though it strains the engine's capabilities. It's quite comfortable at 60, 65 miles per hour in third gear. If the Volt can do the same, then it's worth the wait.
Well, 2 points on that. I mean, the 230 mile per gallon figure, you know, is to try to, you know, get people to accept the fact the Volt is real. However, people shouldn't think they can go 230 miles in a single gallon of gasoline in a single trip. That the figure assumes multiple charging over multiple days, because you're not, you know, going to be doing all that city driving at once. And there are a lot of caveats to the 40 mile electric range. If you go on a steep hill, the engine's going to come on. If you use your radio and your air conditioning excessively, or you speed, you're not going to get that 40 mile electric only range. So I do think, you know, people have to recognize that, one, it's the first generation Volt. They're already working on the second and third. There are going to be, like any brand new vehicle, some bugs in it. But, I think, you know, generally they're going to hit the performance targets.
So if I'm, say, driving from here to New York State, straight up 81, how many times am I going to have to stop in a Volt?
Well, that's the good thing. You're not going to have to. You're going to make it. It's going to have roughly a 300 mile range for that first 40 miles. Roughly, it'll be all electrical driving, and then after that, the gasoline engine will turn on, and it will, you know, charge the electric motor, and that will drive the wheels. So you won't.
It's like having a generator on board.
Huh.
Right.
It's like having a little generator on board where, you know, when you're home and you lose power in your house,
right.
a generator will kick in if you've got one set up and start running things. But as David said, if you start running your hair dryer and your refrigerator and your coffee maker and your dishwasher, you know, that generator is going right. to be used up pretty quickly. The thing to remember too, Diana, and for listeners, is that this is all new. And it is a whole different language that we're talking about here. And so it is similar to when you plug in your cell phone, that's not lasting. You know, that battery isn't going to last like an Energizer alkaline battery because it's different. And you have to learn how to, you know, to train your battery to maximize the performance. It's going to be the same thing, but this time it's a car.
You got to train yourself as well
exactly.
as training your battery, don't you, David?
Exactly. You wake up and you go to work and you forgot to charge your car overnight, and you could be using gasoline.
Out of luck.
Yeah.
Out of luck.
But I want one quick point is that one thing GM said about the EV1 is that it didn't have this backup gasoline engine, and people had range anxiety that, hey, I'm going to run out. I can't make it home. And the key difference with the Volt is, okay, I forgot to, you know, charge the battery up, but I can still get to work because I do have that gasoline engine to charge up the motor.
I do.
And the Nissan, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The Nissan Leaf that's coming out next year, I think maybe even later on this year, they don't have that gasoline backup. It is a purely electric vehicle without any kind of a backup plan.
But the advantage to the Leaf that Nissan was touting, because after GM got so much publicity,
yeah.
is that they would get a 367 mile per gallon rating. So, you know, we're sort of up in the stratosphere here and a lot of big
what
numbers.
About Toyota? Didn't Toyota come out with a 1,000-pound battery pack in the car? Built into the car?
Well, Toyota's got a big plug-in program underway. They're going to have about 500 plug-in hybrids worldwide, 150 here by the end of this year. But those will have a much smaller range than the Volt, probably somewhere in the 10-mile range. Their thinking is, you know, use the plug-ins for very short trips, and you can have a smaller battery pack than GM will have in the Volt.
I have to apologize to our listeners. The phone seemed to be down for the moment. So if you've been trying to get through on 800-433-8850, we'll hope to have these phones back up before the program is over so that you can get your questions and comments in. In the meantime, do send us your email, and we'll try to use those as a substitute for your telephone calls. Tell us about the GM selling cars in California on eBay, David.
Well, it's an interesting program. You know, they will still be working through dealers. There's about, I think, 200 odd dealers that will be doing this program. Basically, it'll allow people to buy a car at a set price or bid on vehicles. And I think it's a way of trying to show that the company is with it and that it's, you know, more technologically savvy. And let's face it, a lot of people, you know, have a lot of apprehension while going to a dealer. They don't think they can make a great deal, or they're convinced they're not, you know, getting the best deal out of the dealer possible.
Here's an email from Sean, who's in Jefferson, North Carolina, who says, with respect to the plug-in electric vehicle trend, I think we could be setting up solar and wind-powered electrical systems for these vehicles. Aren't there billions of dollars of stimulus money for this process? The majority of electricity still comes from coal-powered plants and a less-than-green grid. David.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, one statistic that sticks out with me is that if you're recharging the Volt or another extended-range electric vehicle in West Virginia, your CO2 emissions are actually worse than they are using gasoline, given that all the electricity is coming from coal. So you're right. You know, part of if the goal is to reduce emissions and greenhouse gases, has to be to improve the renewable, you know, portion of the electric grid.
And here's another from Leighton, who says your guests just claim that if you drive less than 30 miles per day, your fuel mileage is infinite. That's preposterous. It does not consider the electric energy that is input by plugging in the plug-in hybrid. Electric energy is fuel. Fuel is required to generate the electric energy. Today, most of our electricity is generated using fossil fuel with attendant greenhouse gas emissions. To ignore consumption of electric energy by this vehicle is misleading. Do you want to comment, Rebecca?
Well, I think that was actually Tony that indicated that it was infinite. But Leighton's absolutely right. You do have to consider all of the ramifications. And as David indicated, there are ramifications there. But the point of the Volt and vehicles coming in the future is twofold. It is certainly to reduce our dependency upon the typical gasoline, you know, combustion engine, which actually works out really well, except uses gasoline. So what's intended with these vehicles is to, you know, really decrease our dependency upon gasoline. The second thing, obviously, is to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, that argument is widespread, and there's a lot of different aspects of it. You know, one way that we can improve our fuel efficiency is by driving more diesel, except the state of California in particular is very concerned about the carcinogenics and whether diesel causes cancer.
Sure.
So, you know, so that's there's always the pros and cons, and you do need to have a very wide range of understanding the consequences.
Yeah, you're right. There's no free lunch in the program, and certainly one, we are going to see electricity prices rise at some level if Congress adopts some sort of cap and trade system. I mean, they're obviously widely differing figures on where electricity is going, but certainly, electricity is not free, and certainly one thing the auto companies are looking at is if we add hundreds of thousands, eventually potentially millions of plug-in vehicles on the roadways, it's going to have a big impact on the grid.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to, for just a moment, get back to this question of cash for clunkers. Is there any indication, David, that Congress might extend the program yet again?
I think it's doubtful. They went through a lot of hoops to get this last $2 billion. Remember, the Transportation Secretary told members of Congress, I think it was July 30th, on a Thursday night, the program's out of money. Based on their initial calculations with the dealers, we're worried that we're already out of money. And that sort of set off a frenzy. Some dealers were open until 3 in the morning getting these last-minute deals done. And the House voted, you know, in record time the next day to transfer $2 billion from the stimulus. There was a lot of arguments in the Senate. I mean, some members, like Senator Dianne Feinstein, wanted to change the program to require tougher improvements in efficiency. And reluctantly, members went along in the Senate to transfer the $2 billion. It passed by just barely enough votes to end debate. So it's hard to see Congress extending it. But on the other hand, it has been, it's certainly increased sales. I mean, through the first 6 months of the year, sales were down 35%. In July, with only a few days of the program, sales were down 12%, and that was the lowest decline in auto sales since May of 2008. So, I mean, and certainly there are some people who are pull-ahead buyers or would have bought anyway, but there are certainly some, as Rebecca pointed out earlier, some used car buyers who for the first time became new car buyers, and that may have a long-term impact on people's buying habits.
And what's happening to these clunkers?
They are being destroyed.
Squished.
Killed. The funny part is in the rule from the government, it explained how you can kill an engine of a vehicle and how they have to do it. They pour a substance into they drain the oil, they pour it in, they turn the motor on, and it basically destroys the engine in just a matter of minutes. And then it's towed off to a junkyard to ensure that these vehicles aren't sold underground or,
But has there been any indication that some of them have been illegally shipped out?
I haven't heard anything. Rebecca, have you heard that? Or
we have not. And I can tell you the Honda dealership that I live nearby and have to drive by on my way to work still has about 25 or 30 of the vehicles all lined up waiting for the crusher, I guess. One thing to remember, too, with this program is that it was originally going to be funded for $4 billion. But they, you know, I think that that panic that David talked about, and I remember well getting the phone call Thursday night saying, you know, chaos has begun. This could have been a program that really sustained sales for a longer period of time if they had managed it a little bit better, if they hadn't had this fire sale, which it turned out really wasn't true. So it's disappointing in that this program really could have been a longer boon for the industry. But
all
we'll
right.
take what we can get at this point.
Short break. More of your email when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org, and by The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how Walmart changed America and the global economy. We talk with Nelson Lichtenstein, whose new book is The Retail Revolution. And we meet Dr. Lisa Sanders, a consultant on the TV show House and author of the Diagnosis column in the New York Times. She says doctors misdiagnose illnesses more than you think. Her new book is Every Patient Tells a Story. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Dear friends, let's all keep our fingers crossed and open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Margate, Florida. Good morning, Al. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
It seems to me that the Volt is like a penalty car because it goes in the hybrid direction where weight of the engine and generator would be used for more batteries, you could accomplish more than 50 miles range. Any conversion out there on the market for $7,000, you can convert a Ford 150 and get 40 miles with iron phosphate batteries, which are, they come from the submarine industry. Why is it that we are, trying to fight two different, fronts when we could apply ourselves directly to electric, like, for example, Tesla or Aptera, do. And they just go electric and they get 230 miles per charge. I think that we're letting other countries, get ahead of us by concentrating on the hybrid.
Interesting points, David.
Well, certainly the different chemistries, different batteries things that different automakers are looking at? And, I mean, you've got the whole range of solutions from fully electric vehicles coming out to the plug-ins to the extended range. So, and yes, there are a lot of companies that have offered these conversion kits, but I think one of the big issues is reliability of these vehicles, that if the first generation of electric vehicles, had some sort of, horrendous, disaster, like remember when the laptop batteries were catching fire, people could be turned off an entire technology. And I think that's one of the reasons that companies are so, worried about ensuring reliability of this first generation.
Yeah. What about his points regarding Europe and Japan, Rebecca?
Well, it's, the issue with when you look at other countries is that they are not like the U.S., and the demands that we put on our vehicles are very different. Public transportation is so completely different in cities like Tokyo, London, Paris. When we look at the States, New York is probably the only city that has a really very competent, fully utilized public transportation system, and maybe San Francisco and D.C. But, our dependency upon different types of vehicles is really what's driven why we look so different. And also because, of course, we don't have penalties in terms of taxation. Europe is so heavily taxed when it comes to what vehicles they can choose. And you do get penalized if you choose the types of vehicles that we do over here. So it's one of the reasons why they're 90% cars and we're 50% cars.
All right. Let's go now to South Bend, Indiana. Good morning, Greg.
Oh, good morning. My wife and I, we had always owned Saturns, and when the Prius came out, it really created a problem for us because we just thought that Saturn would be going in that direction. And so we ended up buying a Prius, and I'll tell you, one of these bolts, I'd buy it in a heartbeat, $40,000. We paid $24,000 for that Prius, and I'd much rather support a union-made, UAW-built car. And all these naysayers, we actually had to talk the dealer into selling us the Prius at the time. They were trying to talk us out of it.
Really?
For all these same reasons. Oh, your payback won't be, that quick and all this stuff. But we bought it anyway, and I wonder how many other people did the same thing.
I bet you love your Prius.
Oh, we do, but I know I have a Pontiac Vibe, and they could have done the same thing with that Vibe. It's the same size, and I really like it, and I drive it, but it could have been a hybrid, too.
Interesting, David.
Well, you make a good point to the caller that, in fact, Saturn was going to have a plug-in hybrid as part of GM's efforts, but as part of GM's restructuring and bankruptcy, the company is shedding four of the brands, and both Pontiac and Saturn are brands that GM is selling or getting rid of. So you're right. I think one of the things the Saturn brand was trying to do was position itself as a lot of smaller cars and more environmentally friendly. But GM is now deciding to focus on these four core brands and will have that plug-in hybrid as a Buick rather than a Saturn in 2011.
In order to remain more economically viable.
Right, and to shrink. And it's very expensive to, support eight brands and
exactly.
Advertising. And, with four brands, the thinking is smaller and more profitable.
All right, to Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi there, John.
Good morning. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm surprised that nobody has brought up the Nissan Leaf yet, which I believe is maybe coming out sooner, but I'm not sure, coming out before the Volt. And I believe that gets 100 miles on a single charge. And if that's true, I hate to say it, it's like the American car manufacturer is getting beaten to the punch again. I wonder if you could comment on that.
David.
Well, we did briefly talk about it, and you're right that it will be all electric, and it will have a similar range, in fact, to what the EV1 had, probably slightly longer, and on a miles per gallon basis, it's supposed to be about 367, although it's hard to truly have that if you're not using any gasoline. But I think it's just a question of difference in use. If you have only 100-mile range, you're right. Sure, for a lot of trips, it's great. But if, as Diane said, if you're on the way up to New York and or you end up in traffic, you could run out of juice. And I think it's just a difference in, you know, how comfortable are you with, you know, not having any options if you run out of power.
And that Leaf is due out in 2011. Is that correct?
It's roughly end of 2010, early 2011. Is that right, Rebecca?
I thought the Leaf was due out early 2010, actually. But they're only planning on selling 5,000 of them.
Right.
So it's a very, very limited production run.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have any kind of backup. It is purely electric.
Okay. Now, we touched on this earlier, but I'd like to understand from both of you what kind of adaptations are going to have to be made by cities and states around the country to accommodate these electric plug-in cars. What are we going to have to do, Rebecca?
Well, this is one of my favorite questions, as we talked about at the beginning of the hour,
sure.
Because I'm in your situation. Some of the things that I've thought of, and I've talked to GM a little bit about, and again, you know, I'm not an engineer, so this is just purely sort of just, you know, looking at this question. Things like turning parking meters in, you know, electrifying parking meters. So when you put quarters in to pay for your parking spot, you can plug in your car as well. Working with retail outlets. You know, you go in for a cup of coffee at, you know, whichever location you prefer, and you're able to recharge your vehicle for, you know, a small fee.
McDonald's has a whole new outlet.
Right. Exactly. You know, so I think that it's important that we need to get very creative with solving this problem, which is a you know, really future thinking, but getting very creative with this, you know, and I think we're all familiar with the Jetsons, and when they pull in their, you know, supercar and they park it in this really cool garagey sort of thing, you know, that's going to be our reality to some extent. I don't think we're going to be flying quite yet, but really thinking outside the box when it comes to adapting our behavior to suit these vehicles.
All right. Let's see. Ruben is on Long Island, New York. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, Diane. Good evening, panel. How are you
feeling?
Hi there.
Fine, thanks.
There's two questions. The first one is, I keep hearing about small electric cars, but I'm a 6'3", and I cannot, and my legs are long. I cannot in a small Prius. That just don't happen. I wanted to know, first of all, are they planning on making an electric car, actually an electric SUV that can fit guys tall, big like myself? And secondly, how come Ford or any of the big three, or if it depends, have ever heard of a car called the Alica? It's an electric car. It goes 200-mile range. It goes 230 miles an hour. It done beat the Porsche 911 and Carrera. And I want to know how come, and it's run totally on electric, lithium ion, and is made from Kyoto University in Japan.
Well, let me go to your first point. I mean, I feel your pain. I'm about 6'5", and I know in some smaller vehicles there's not a lot of headroom. And GM, for example, is bringing that plug-in technology to a crossover, a larger vehicle, although not as, you know, not as big as some of the full-size SUVs. But I think the reason the technology is on small cars, first of all, is that they're smaller, lighter weight. They need smaller batteries. But as plug-ins and electric vehicle technology extends across the fleet, they are going to move to larger vehicles. You know, GM has had its hybrid technology on full-size vehicles, which, you know, has, you know, seen a dramatic improvement in fuel efficiency, but it's also very expensive on those largest vehicles.
Any other comment, Rebecca?
Well, I think David's right. He is very tall, and I'm very short, so we look fun together. But, you know, it is, and you are always going to hear about vehicles like the Alita. There are all these, you know, garage people that are working on these types of vehicles. And by all means, that's why Tesla got $500 million from the mm-hmm. U.S. government. Mm. So we are continuing to see these. The issue is, are they mass producible? And can you actually get them out to the mass public? And so you can always invent, you know, one or two things of something, but it is looking at driving them in all types of conditions and for all types of people. But I didn't get your first name on Long Island, but it is an issue that they're definitely addressing in terms of trying to get them onto different sized vehicles.
Okay.
And you will see them in the future.
Thanks for calling, Ruben. And now to Steve. He's in Northern California. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's as quick as I can see you have much less than 10 minutes left.
Yeah.
Somewhat on the same subject, I've been living off the power grid since 1975. I moved out here from the East Coast, and I have never had an electric bill. I charge deep cell batteries with photovoltaic panels, and then that goes through an inverter, and then I get regular house current. And in California and all the sunny states in this country, it's optimum for photovoltaics. And as much as I dislike oil companies, I must give credit where credit's due. ARCO Company was one of the first companies to come out with photovoltaics, and I bought two of their panels back in 1975. And they lasted about 8 years, and I recently bought two Chinese panels. That it's a 12-volt system. I could upgrade it to 24, but I don't have the money right now. So that just
Steve,
wanted to get a plug for that.
Steve, I used to live in San Francisco, and I'm a huge advocate of solar and wind power. And this is where the general public needs to contact their congressmen and their senators. We had a situation here in Massachusetts, and you know, Senator Kennedy was always in favor of this right up until the wind power was going to be put in Cape Cod Bay and possibly within the view of him and his neighbors. And I think that wind farms are gorgeous, but they didn't want to see them from the beach. And so I think that this is a situation where we do need to make compromises that, you know, it may not be the perfect solution, but we've got to come up with different things than just depending upon the old technology. So good for you. I think that's terrific.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David.
And I do think that if we're all plugging in our vehicles, there's going to be a lot more interest in putting those solar panels on or putting up that wind turbine up and, you know, getting to drive your car essentially for free at that point.
And to Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Good morning, Danny.
Thank you. What is the life expectancy of the lithium-ion battery and the cost of replacement? And I also think that you've made a large mistake when you've omitted the Pontiac. I think the Solstice is one of the prettiest cars on the market.
May I?
Sure.
Danny, the lithium-ion battery question I'm going to leave to David, but the Pontiac question, I did talk with GM, and they basically had 7 or 8 different business plans that they tried to put through to make Pontiac work, and they just couldn't make money on it. It's not a global brand, and even when they were sharing technology with Holden in Australia, they still couldn't make a business case for it. And it's a crime because it is that quintessential, fabulous, rear-wheel drive American muscle car brand. And they did not make the decision lightly. I will tell you that a lot of thought went into it, a lot of pain, a lot of hours of trying to make the brand work. And unfortunately, to some extent, it's also not a brand that a lot of government people really understand, because they tend towards more white collar brands. Brands like Toyota and Honda, which are great brands, but they aren't for that American muscle car brand. So I agree with you. It's a shame.
And on the Pontiac, you know, there was some brief talk after the company emerged that they would try to keep this G8, which is an Australian rear wheel drive vehicle, and you're right, along with the Solstice. But I don't, at this point, you know, the company, as Rebecca pointed out, just couldn't find a way to keep the brand alive, even though it has been such an iconic brand for so long.
The other part of our caller's question, the lifespan, right, and the cost of replacement.
GM hasn't given the cost. It's assumed to be roughly $10,000, and that's one of the big issues in
for the battery.
For the battery pack. And they are, you know, sort of guaranteeing, I think, a 100,000-mile range, or at least that's in part because the California warranty laws require vehicles to be able to last for 100,000 miles. And but you're right, second and third generation is a big area about reducing the cost of batteries, improving reliability, because at the end of the day, the reason we don't have plug-ins all over the country today is because battery technology hasn't been reliable or cheap enough to make it compete against oil.
How quickly are we going to see all this happen?
I think very quickly, as Rebecca pointed out, with Tesla, the government is putting a huge amount of money into this. They have a $25 billion low-cost retooling program. They awarded Ford about $6 billion, another $2.4 billion in grants, cash that doesn't have to be repaid on batteries. So, you know, there's a lot of money going into this, and with the prospect of oil eventually going back to $4 or $5, $10 a gallon eventually, it is it's a national priority.
David Shepardson, Washington Bureau Chief with the Detroit News. Rebecca Lindland, she's Director of Automotive Research for IHS Global Insight. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.